Welcome to Hodgkin Lymphoma Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. David Strauss from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York, and to begin, he presented a patient from his practice.
This was a 25-year-old woman with stage 2A classical Hodgkin lymphoma, nodular sclerosis type. The disease was not bulky, and the sites involved were left supraclavicular nodes and mediastinal nodes. So she was treated according to a regimen that we conducted in a clinical trial, a phase 2 trial, led by Alliance CALGB, but also with Southwest Oncology Group and Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group, in which patients with stage 1 and 2 A and B without tumor bulk were treated with two cycles of ABVD, doxorubicin, bleomycin, vinblastine, and dacarbazine. An interim PET was performed, PET-CT, and this was reviewed centrally by two reviewers and an adjudicator in case of a disagreement. The PET was interpreted and scored according to Deauville criteria, Deauville 1, 2, and 3, which is negative or activity less than liver uptake. That was counted as PET negative. PET positive was Deauville 5 and 6, so that's greater than liver uptake or new sites and increased uptake. So in this trial, there were 164 patients. 91% were PET negative at the end of two cycles of ABVD. Those patients went on to get two more cycles of ABVD without radiation therapy, while patients who were PET positive got more intensive chemotherapy with escalated BCOP and involved field radiation therapy. So what we found is that 91% of the patients were PET negative, and their three-year progression-free survival, which was the primary endpoint of the trial, was 91%. PET-positive patients with escalated BCOP and radiation therapy had about a 66% three-year progression-free survival, which we didn't think was really that promising. So we don't really know what to do with the PET-positive patients, but for the majority of patients, we showed that you can get an excellent result without radiation therapy using interim PET to identify PET-negative patients. Of interest, the sites of relapse in the PET-negative patients, there were 14 relapses, and 11 of them were in initially involved nodal sites that would have been radiated if they had a combination of chemotherapy and radiation therapy. Those patients can be often salvaged with just radiation therapy to those sites. And if they do relapse, they can get further chemotherapy and even autologous transplant, but it is not necessary in most patients. The only death in the trial was due to a suicide. There were no deaths due to Hodgkin lymphoma. So we think this is an excellent result and avoids the potential late risks of radiation therapy in the majority of patients. And so that's what we did with this young woman. She had two cycles of ABVD. Her interim PET was negative. She completed two more cycles of ABVD, and she was in a CR by PET criteria at the end of treatment and remains in CR now for close to a year.
So is this your current approach outside a trial setting?
Yes, this is my current approach, and many people in North America are doing this. I mean, there are other approaches, but we think this is a very acceptable approach.
And you take the same approach whether it's a man or a woman?
Yes, we didn't see any difference between males and females. We didn't see any difference between 1A, 2A, and 1B, 2B. And actually, we also looked at prognostic scores that are used to stratify patients in Europe. Early stage favorable, early stage unfavorable. There's the German Hodgkin Study Group criteria. There's the ERTC criteria. We looked at our patients, and there was no difference between early stage favorable, early stage unfavorable. So we think it's simpler to just say stage 1 and 2 non-bulky.
You referred to other approaches. What other approaches do people do in practice? And what are some of the research issues out there?
Well, the chemotherapy-only approach has also been used in a large randomized trial, the RAPID trial from Great Britain, where patients with stage 1 and 2A, not B, favorable, received 3 cycles of ABVD and underwent PET-CT. Patients who were PET positive, which was about 25%, received an additional cycle of ABVD and involved field radiation therapy, while those who were PET negative after 3 cycles were randomized to no further treatment or to receive radiation therapy. In that trial, there was a slightly higher relapse rate for the patients who just received chemotherapy without the radiation therapy. However, in the intent to treat analysis, which was a primary endpoint, there was no statistical difference. So again, that's another study that I think supports the use of chemotherapy only in these patients. So the other approach is combined modalities, chemotherapy and radiation therapy. And I think the standard would probably be 2 cycles of ABVD and involved field radiation therapy. And this was for early stage favorable in the German Hodgkin study group HD10 trial. So the issue is there is undisputably a 5 to 10% higher relapse rate for patients who are just treated with chemotherapy. So the issue is whether you radiate everybody to get that 5 to 10% better progression-free survival, or whether you accept that approximately 90% of patients won't require the radiation therapy, avoiding the risks, and can be effectively salvaged, sometimes even just with radiation therapy, not necessarily requiring a transplant. And so that is kind of the dispute, I think, that is current in early stage Hodgkin lymphoma. I just would add that the Europeans conducted a randomized trial of the risk-adapted approach using interim PET, chemotherapy only for PET negative, BICOP, and radiation therapy for PET positive, versus standard arm was combined modality treatment, ABVD plus radiation therapy. Unfortunately, that trial did not meet its primary endpoint because of a stopping rule which mandated that they stop it after a certain number of relapses. So as a result, the trial was stopped at a median time of about a year at a time when the risk-adapted arm with PET scanning had a PFS of 95%. So I think that was a problem with that trial, so they couldn't really meet their primary endpoint. However, they did publish longer-term follow-up of the patients who were treated on the trial, and their results, basically for PET-negative patients, all patients got interim PET. In the standard arm, they were treated with radiation therapy anyway. So the PFS for the patients in the standard arm was about 12% better than in the PET-adapted arm, which is very similar to our 91%. So again, they concluded that everybody should get radiation therapy, and we conclude that 10% is okay and you can salvage these patients and avoid risks in the majority. So that's kind of the issue now in early stage Hodgkin lymphoma, and there is, you know, there are differences of opinion.
So I'm curious about your global take on the risk of radiation therapy today. You send a patient, they're going to the Memorial Radiation Therapy Department, they're going to get the best possible radiation they can. But what would you say to a patient in terms of what their long-term risk is of some significant complication, cardiovascular, second cancer, that would be a serious problem? What's your global take on that?
Well, you know, radiation therapy has its place, and I think actually, I applaud the younger generation of radiation oncologists who say, look, we have a treatment that is not safe. There's no safe dose. We want to figure out when to use it, when it's not needed, and when we do use it, we want to give it as safely as possible. I think the group treating breast cancer has really pioneered this attitude. So the radiation therapy that's given today, they're really iterations of what are called involved field radiation therapy. So this means that all sites that are initially involved are radiated, regardless of whether they resolve after chemotherapy. So they have newer iterations that are called involved site radiation therapy and involved node radiation therapy that shrink the size of the post-treatment ports. However, they still treat all the initial involved sites. The mediastinum is particularly a problem. This results in significant exposure of off-target sites such as the heart, breast, neck, lungs, and so forth, although it is somewhat less than with other types of radiation therapy. So the risk is not going to be zero. Whether the results of this approach will result in 10 to 20 years in less second primary cancers, less cardiovascular disease, I think is an open question. There's some data suggesting that involved field radiation therapy, the older version of this, still is associated with significant events. But again, you know, these are things that are seen 10 to 20 years later, and, you know, we'll have to wait to see. But I think that the dosimetry, where they can actually look at the exposure to off-target sites, can be kind of a surrogate for what we might expect.
Do you have any rough global estimate on the global risk?
Well, you know, we know, for example, with more extensive radiation therapy, that the risk of second cancers is about 1% per year. So at 20 years, it's about 20%. And we know that there is a dose-related risk of coronary artery disease with increasing doses of radiation, with really no zero risk. So we don't know with these somewhat reduced fields whether this will be improved or not.
What about the patient who's PET positive, the 9% or 10%?
Well, that is a real problem. We don't think that escalated BCOP, and radiation therapy, you know, with a 30% relapse rate is that great. And also trials, we'll talk about advanced stage disease in another case, but also PET-adapted approaches using BCOP for PET-positive patients also has about a 30% relapse rate, and with the risks of high-dose chemotherapy. So I think the question of what to do with the PET-positive patients is not answered by clinical trials. I mean, I use an individualized approach. So if a patient is a little bit PET-positive but is kind of going in the right direction on the interim PET, I'll continue them on ABVD. I might give them a total of 6 cycles rather than 4 cycles, and then we'll do an end-of-treatment PET, which is really the criteria for response. That's the gold standard. If they're still PET positive, I will biopsy them. If I think that it is, you know, really suspicious that there's persistent disease, there are a lot of false positives with PET. If it's, again, it's better and I think it could be a false positive, I might follow them and just repeat the PET at 2 or 3 months. So I think we don't really know with these risk-adapted approaches what the best treatment is for PET-positive patients.
For, you know, again, outside a trial setting, you said a patient who's responding but not quite PET-positive and PET-negative. What about the patient who's primarily refractory?
Well, any patients who's primarily refractory, you're going to want to investigate. I mean, somebody seems to be progressing. I mean, you will, even before we had PET, you'd work that up, you'd biopsy them, and so on.
Yeah, well, maybe that was too strong. I was just trying to get the other. You said if the patient was really responding well, you keep the treatment going.
If I think the patient is, I'm really concerned that they're not responding, I would biopsy them. And then I would, on the basis of that, I would go to other treatment. Usually in a young patient, this would be a program leading to autologous transplant and probably would include radiation therapy.
Right. So let's also briefly touch on the issue of SAGE 2A with bulky disease. And you have a 19-year-old lady. What happened with her?
Yes. So this was a young woman with bulky stage 2A Hodgkin lymphoma with a bulky mediastinal mass, which classically is defined as where the ratio of the mass, the maximum diameter of the mass to the maximum diameter of the chest wall in a plain chest X-ray is greater than 1/3, or a peripheral mass is greater than 10 centimeters. And she had right supraclavicular nodal involvement and bulky mediastinal adenopathy. She received 6 cycles of ABVD, and this was from 2013 to 2014. Her end of treatment PET CT was negative, and I did not add radiation therapy, and I'll get into the reasons for that. And she is done fine, has had no evidence of recurrence. And actually, I just discharged her from 4.5-year follow-up in continuous remission, and she will contact me for the unlikely but not impossible event of a recurrence. So this is really based on sort of limited data, which was initially presented as a presentation at the ASH meeting in 2007 by Kerry Savage of the British Columbia Cancer Agency. They have provincial health care, government health care, so they set policies for the province. So they set a policy that patients with stage 3 and 4 Hodgkin lymphoma or stage 2 bulky Hodgkin lymphoma would receive 6 cycles of ABVD. Those who had residual masses of 2 centimeters or greater would undergo PET scanning. The rest would not and would just be followed without radiation therapy. And so the patients who had residual masses who were PET negative received no further therapy, just like those who did not have a residual mass. Those who were PET positive received radiation therapy. So what they found was that patients with residual masses who underwent PET scanning, if the PET was negative, they had the same excellent outcome as those who did not have residual masses. They then further went into the weeds and they looked at the patients who underwent PET scanning according to whether they initially had bulky disease. And those patients who had initial bulky disease and underwent PET scanning where the PET was negative had the same excellent outcome without radiation therapy. And that was the basis for me not radiating patients with bulky mediastinal disease for 10 years. And somewhat disappointingly, rather than publishing this, they presented another abstract at ASH in 2015 reporting the same results with longer follow-up. So on the basis of this, because of my concern, particularly in young women like this patient who are particularly vulnerable to these long-term effects of radiation therapy, I stopped giving these patients radiation therapy. I was kind of in the minority of our group. People still were continuing to give radiation therapy regardless of whether the PET scan was positive or negative. And I probably have 10 to 15 patients over the last 10 years. Not a single one has relapsed, not one, which is an anecdote. So I think, I mean, in my practice, I really do not like to radiate these patients. Now, we have a clinical trial, which actually is using 4 cycles of brentuximab vedotin plus doxorubicin, vinblastine, dacarbazine. And we had 4 cohorts, 2 of which got involved site radiation therapy, standard radiation therapy, 20 gray, 30 patients, 30 gray, 30 patients. And a 3rd cohort got what they call consolidation volume, or what we have called residual site radiation therapy, which I'll get into in a minute, and a 4th cohort is just receiving chemotherapy. So we're on the 4th cohort, and so currently on a clinical trial, everybody in our institution is treating with 4 cycles of brentuximab vedotin plus AVD. And they are doing treatment planning for the different types of radiation therapy, theoretic ones, even in the group that's just receiving chemotherapy.
So, yeah, sort of an obvious question, which is if a patient like the same one you just described presents today and they are not eligible to be in a clinical trial, what therapy would you likely utilize?
The standard, as far as I'm concerned, would be 6 cycles of ABVD, for which there is experience and data. And then I would do a PET scan, and if the PET is negative, I would not give radiation therapy.
What do you think a randomized trial, if there is one, of, I call it BV-ABD versus ABVD in this situation would show?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was at the International Symposium on Hodgkin Lymphoma, the 11th one in Cologne, and a trial was conducted by the LISA group in France for early stage unfavorable patients. And actually, about 60% of these patients had bulky disease, so a lot of bulky patients. It was a randomized phase two in which one arm received four cycles of ABVD, interim PET, and regardless received radiation therapy, and the other arm received four cycles of brentuximab vedotin plus AVD, four cycles and radiation therapy, also with an interim PET. And the primary endpoint was the PET positivity with the interim PET. And what they found was that there was about a 10% higher percentage of patients who were PET negative in the brentuximab vedotin plus AVD group as compared to the ABVD group, suggesting that maybe brentuximab plus AVD could further improve the 91% we saw with ABVD in early stage. It could further improve it. So I think brentuximab vedotin plus AVD is not approved for early stage Hodgkin lymphoma, but I think there are clinical trials and it might eventually be used in the earlier stage setting.
I mean, I guess you could say that's not a big surprise, those results you described, correct?
Well, I mean, we'll talk about advanced stage disease. Yes, there is a better PFS, though not very large, in advanced stage disease for brentuximab vedotin plus AVD versus ABVD. So I guess in early stage, it's not surprising that there may be a higher response rate.
You know, it's interesting. We're doing a big project right now on breast cancer in the adjuvant setting. And, you know, you see these situations where people choose between therapies that, you know, there's maybe a 1 or 2 or 5% difference and kind of means a lot. You know, here's a situation too. I mean, relapse in this situation is not a great thing to go through, but we'll see, I guess, how the trial data and how the practice evolves in this regard though, huh?
Well, I think one difference between breast cancer and Hodgkin lymphoma is that salvage treatment is highly curative and it may not even require intensive chemotherapy with transplant, maybe just even radiation therapy. So we have more of a more wiggle room with
absolutely
Hodgkin lymphoma.
No, I brought that same cancer thing up, and you know, the Hodgkin people said the same thing. But to me, the thing that is similar is the fact that, you know, you do see that patients can understand some of this numeracy. I mean, you know, it is a little bit tricky, and it's, you know, important to try to explain it to them. But, you know, these shades of difference, there are a lot of patients who are at least interested in learning about it. How about if I say that?
Very good. I'd like to say a word about even more, you know, reducing the size of the radiation therapy portals even further than is done now. So my radiation oncology colleague, Oren Kalon, and I wrote a viewpoint for JAMA Oncology entitled, Can Radiation Therapy Be Given More Safely in Early Stage Hodgkin Lymphoma If Necessary? And we suggested that in PET negative patients, there may be, even with bulky disease, there may be a 5 to 10% difference in relapse rate, although an excellent salvage. Could you cut down the potential risks of the radiation therapy by further decreasing the size of the portals? So instead of radiating all initial sites, as is done in all standard radiation therapy now, we suggested that maybe if you have a small mass, say in the mediastinum, maybe just radiate the residual mass. So in this brief viewpoint opinion, we did a theoretic portal and an actual portal for involved site radiation therapy and what we called residual site radiation therapy in a patient who was treated with involved site radiation therapy with that thing. We did a theoretic residual site plan. And the involved site plan had substantial exposure to the heart, the dosimetry to the heart, lungs, and breasts. Whereas in this particular patient, possibly due to the location of the residual mass, we got it way down to less than 1 gray. So this is actually being investigated in our current clinical trial in the cohort that got what they call consolidation volume radiation therapy. And actually, I've looked at the treatment plans with the radiation oncologist. It's very interesting. Some patients, you can really get the dose down if you just treat the residual site. Other patients, not as much. And it depends on the size of the mass and kind of the location of the mass and so on. So I think reducing the ports of radiation therapy when it's used is something that's under investigation. And I think, as I say, my friends who are radiation oncologists in breast cancer have really pioneered this concept, I think, in breast cancer, where they're trying to do the same thing.
Well, that study that you're doing with the BV-AVD with the four cohorts sounds really interesting, you know, trying to just, you know, without trying to do a really long randomized trial, you just go out there and try stuff and see how it works. I like it.
Well, you know, you're right. I mean, but it's 30 patients in each arm, so it's going to be kind of hypothesis generating. I mean, it's not going to be powered to really show a difference between these different cohorts, but I think definitely hypothesis generating, and I think it's a very good study.
Well, again, forgive me for using the breast cancer analogy, but there's this sort of very well-known trial where they just did one arm of this low toxic, you know, minimally toxic therapy, trastuzumab and paclitaxel. They got fantastic results, like I think 2% mets, whatever, but it was only one arm, but people took that and did it, and, you know, maybe this kind of approach, you know, gets results quicker.
Yeah, phase two studies. We showed the same thing with 164 patients in a phase two study that was powered properly as they did in the over 1,000 patient HDH10 study, which they had to stop because of the stopping rule and so on. So, you know, I mean, I think that, the gold standard is randomized controlled trials, no question. But I think that phase two studies properly designed and powered can give important information of clinical relevance.
And sometimes the randomized trials, they just take so long to get done. By the time they report, they're not even relevant. But anyhow,
well, it's more of a problem with Hodgkin lymphoma than breast cancer, because Hodgkin lymphoma is much less common than breast cancer.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, it takes.
Absolutely. Yeah. So before we go on, though, I'm just kind of curious, these two patients, these two women, the 25-year-old and the 19-year-old, how did they actually present? How did they find out? Did they feel a node or what happened?
Yeah, I don't recall exactly. I think they both felt a node. You know, I mean, that's very typical. Neither one had B symptoms, fevers, night sweats, or weight loss. And, you know, that's very typical. Somebody's taking a shower and they say, how did that get there? Or they're shaving and, you know, that's a very typical story. I don't remember exactly with these two patients, but I think that that's how they noticed it.
So, of course, you know, every time I interview somebody who's done research in Hodgkin lymphoma, of course, everybody wants to know what you're doing up front for extensive stage disease. What do you think about echelon one? So I asked you to pick out a patient to present that we could use to sort of get into that. Maybe to get into that, we can start out with your 27-year-old man.
So this was a 27-year-old man with stage 4B classical Hodgkin lymphoma, nodular sclerosis type. And he had 5 of 7 adverse risk factors by the International Prognostic Score, which consisted of male sex. He had a serum albumin of less than 4. It was 3.1. He was stage 4 disease. His extranodal involvement, making him stage 4, was bone involvement. He was anemic with a hemoglobin of less than 10.5. His hemoglobin was 8.6. He had a leukocytosis of greater than 15,000. It was 17,500. And we know that patients with multiple adverse risk factors in the International Prognostic Score have a worse progression-free survival and overall survival than those with less risk factors, although it's not totally terrible. And as I'll get to, I treated him with brentuximab vedotin and AVD. This was after the completion of the clinical trial that led to the approval of brentuximab vedotin in this setting, and I selected it for this patient according to results of the clinical trial, the Echelon 1 trial. So this was a large, randomized, controlled, prospective study, open label, international study of over 1,200 patients with stage 3 and 4 disease who were randomized to either 6 cycles of ABVD or 6 cycles of brentuximab vedotin plus AVD. The primary endpoint was a modification, which is a little complicated to explain, progression-free survival at 2 years. I won't really get into this because it was a little hard to understand, but bottom line is that analysis according to regular progression-free survival was really not different. And this trial showed a better modified progression-free survival at 2 years for the brentuximab vedotin plus AVD arm as compared with the ABVD arm. And the difference was not huge, but it was statistically significant. It was approximately 5%. So this met the primary endpoint of the trial, and the FDA granted approval of brentuximab vedotin for use as frontline treatment in stages 3 and 4 Hodgkin lymphoma. So the question is really whether everybody should get this or whether only some patients should get it, and that is really not been completely settled. So there are secondary studies involved with the ECHELON trial, which are looking at prognostic factors that may identify subgroups that particularly benefited. I would add that we participated in the ECHELON 1 trial. In fact, we were the largest accruing single center in the world. We accrued 44 patients. I'm actually third author on the paper because an investigator in Poland got credit for the entire country of Poland, so he's author number two. But anyway, we were very heavily involved with this, and I'm involved also with some of the post hoc subset analyses. But in the primary analysis, subgroups were identified where they seemed to benefit from the brentuximab vedotin AVD arm. Some of these in a forest plot would cross the midline, so are not completely statistically significant, but the patients who seemed to benefit were patients, male sex, stage 4, multiple adverse risk factors in the international prognostic score, and actually, interestingly, where North America versus other sites, North American patients did a bit better. And this is the reason that in this particular patient, so we're not in the clinical trial anymore, we're off trial, we don't have a clinical trial at that time for these patients. So I decided to treat with BV plus AVD because I thought that he is possibly in a subgroup who would benefit. And he has actually just completed treatment. His PET scan is negative and he will be followed. So I think that we're kind of in the process of trying to figure out what patients might benefit the most from this approach.
So could you talk a little bit about how this particular patient tolerated the treatment? Was there any neuropathy?
Yeah, so that's an issue of the side effects. Certainly if you have results that are quite close, I think that the side effects that lead to discontinuation of treatment in particular are of concern. And so this patient tolerated treatment reasonably well. We use growth factor. We use GCSF. I use pegylated GCSF for these patients. There was a safety analysis during the ECHELON trial because growth factor use was not mandated, and it found that in the BV plus AVD arm, there was an excess of febrile neutropenia, neutropenia with infection, and even some deaths from that. And so during the trial, on the basis of the safety analysis, it was recommended that growth factor be used. And so that's why we treated with growth factor. We have looked at, I'm involved with a subset analysis, where growth factor is used prophylactically. In the patients where it was used prophylactically, the subset in the ECHELON trial, some patients got it, some patients didn't, that the febrile neutropenia rate was around, I think it was 11%, which is about the neutropenia rate with R-CHOP. So we think that the neutropenia risk and so on is much reduced with the use of prophylactic growth factor. The second major side effect is peripheral neuropathy, and the scoring for peripheral neuropathy is a little bit imperfect because grade 2 other toxicities is not considered to be important, but grade 2 sensory neuropathy is neuropathy that interferes with functioning, so it is a significant neuropathy. So the peripheral neuropathy was higher with BV plus AVD, which is not surprising because BV and vinblastine are both tubulin inhibitors with the same toxicity. Most of the neuropathy improved, though some did not go away completely. And this particular patient has no neuropathy now.
No neuropathy, no neutropenic complications?
No, and he got growth factor. So neuropathy, sensory neuropathy is a significant problem with brentuximab plus AVD. I think what it avoids is the risks of bleomycin, which are the most significant risk factors in ABVD, which results in pulmonary toxicity, which is significant, can lead to delays and even lead to fatalities. So the BV plus AVD arm avoids the exposure to bleomycin completely. And I think for patients who are at particularly high risk for bleomycin toxicity, which would be patients over the age of 50 or patients with significant lung disease, the BV plus AVD is an attractive option which avoids bleomycin exposure. And bleomycin toxicity, not surprisingly, was higher. Lung toxicity, pulmonary toxicity was, and some deaths were higher in the ABVD arm in the Echelon trial.
I have heard people say that in patients, actually I've heard age 60, it's interesting, you just said age 50, that they would think about just AVD. Do you think there's any logic to that? I mean, it seems like you'd want to do BV-AVD, but any thoughts about that?
Well, there's no data, unfortunately. We've been trying to get rid of bleomycin for years. We even had a trial in CALGB using doxorubicin, vinblastine, and gemcitabine in eliminating bleomycin. Unfortunately, the PFS for that study was not as good as ABVD, so it's been very difficult to get rid of bleomycin. There is data with AVD plus radiation therapy. So there was the HD13 trial, the German Hodgkin study group for early stage favorable, which randomized patients to 2 cycles of the standard combined modality treatment, ABVD plus radiation therapy, which, as I mentioned, is kind of the standard from their previous HD10 trial, versus AV plus radiation therapy, AVD plus radiation therapy, and ABV plus radiation therapy. So the PFS results from that trial for AVD plus radiation therapy were the same as ABVD, and it was inferior for AV radiation therapy or ABV radiation therapy. So I think there's data for AVD plus radiation therapy, and we do know that if we drop bleomycin from treatment because of pulmonary symptoms, that the outcomes are no different than if we had continued it. You know, that's fine. But, you know, AVD alone as only treatment has not been studied. I should mention another study, the RATHL trial, again in stage 3 and 4 disease, and I think bulky 2B was also included. This trial used interim PET, again, another interim PET study. These patients got 2 cycles of ABVD. They had an interim PET. PET-positive patients, as in the early stage trial, went on to get Biocop, no radiation therapy for stage 3 and 4 disease, and again, about a 30% relapse rate. About 80% of the patients were negative after 2 cycles of ABVD, and they were randomized to either complete 4 cycles of ABVD, a total of 6, or drop the bleomycin, 4 cycles of AVD, so 2 ABVD and 4 cycles of AVD for the interim PET negative, and the progression-free survival, survival, and so on was identical for both arms. So there is data for dropping bleomycin with interim PET negativity, but as a standalone, there's just no data. And I know people do it, but I'm a little conservative. I mean, I really sort of hate, I mean, a curable disease, I mean, I hate to go and use something where there really isn't published experience.
So I want to ask you a couple sort of basic clinical questions related to efficacy. And I'd like you to think again about the same case, this 27-year-old man, and maybe you actually had this conversation with him. But if he had asked you, what is the chance that I'm going to have a relapse if I take ABVD? And what's the chance that I'm going to have a relapse if I take BVAVD? What numbers would you or did you give him?
Well, I guess the, you know, is like, I'm just trying to remember. I think it was 72% 2-year modified progression-free survival for ABVD and 83% for BV plus AVD. So I'd say, you know, it would be, in either case, it would be 70 to 80%, closer in the low 80s, you know, based on the trial data for BV plus AVD, and maybe in the 70s for ABVD. Although, with his multiple adverse risk factors, there might be a bigger difference than 5%, because he may actually be in a subgroup that even would benefit more than the 5% difference.
So it sounds like he would have maybe in the range of 20% chance or relapse.
Well, I don't know, 20% chance, but maybe more like 10% chance.
I was saying with ABVD.
10 to 15% chance.
That maybe it might be a difference in him of, say, 10%?
Yeah.
And I'm also curious how you come up with these numbers. I heard you, you know, sort of go through your thinking for him. You know, one of the things, you know, that's looked at a lot is hazard rate. And, you know, for example, I'm looking at the paper now. I see the hazard rate. One was for progression, death, or modified progression was 0.77, so 23% relative reduction. The other was 0.72, 0.28. I guess my question is, again, kind of the adjuvant model, breast, colon, lung, et cetera, which is kind of it's a little bit different, but they apply that risk reduction, relative risk reduction, equally across the risk categories, so that the absolute benefit tends to be greater in the higher risk patient. Is that kind of the way the numbers work in Hodgkin also?
Well, it sounds better if you say a 23% reduction in relapse rate. It sounds a little bit worse if it's actually a 5%
yeah, difference. Yeah, no, I'm just saying in terms of the way you calculate it.
Yeah, I'm not really a statistician. I mean, I thought that, you
yeah,
know,
but you're a clinician.
I thought you should give both. You should give the reduction of risk of recurrence plus the actual difference in the two arms. So again, there is a benefit and it's consistent, but it's not very large. And given the expense of brentuximab vedotin, I mean, to look, you know, for this small difference, I mean, there's some pushback. I mean, people say, well, look, you know, it's not really that much of a difference to justify the costs. So that, I think, has been a matter of pushback in those who, you know, really do not want to give everybody now BV plus AVD. And I think the RATHL trial allows you to eliminate bleomycin after 2 cycles with a negative PET. And, you know, that may reduce the bleomycin risk to some extent. It did in that trial. However, bleomycin toxicity is somewhat idiosyncratic, so you can even get it in the first or second cycle. So it doesn't completely eliminate that, although maybe dropping bleomycin after 2 cycles in PET negative, interim PET negative patients does reduce somewhat the bleomycin risk. In my own view, I don't think I'm really necessarily prepared to give everybody with stage 3 and 4 disease BV plus AVD, but I think I'd like to look at subsets that, you know, really seem to benefit. Another interesting analysis is North America versus other sites. So in North America, the style of treatment is a little bit different. Drugs are more given on time, less delays, treat through neutropenia because febrile neutropenia with ABVD is rare, even though neutropenia, stage 3 and 4 neutropenia, is common. And so an analysis showed a somewhat better PFS for patients treated in North America as compared to other places where there were more dose delays and so on. Dose intensity seemed to be a little bit better in North America, which maybe this would account for the difference. So that's another thing that I think is going to be interesting. I think that the sponsor of the Echelon trial is planning a phase 4 study in North America, probably with more community organizations and academic sites, of BV plus AVD mandating prophylactic growth factor use. And it'll be very interesting to see, number one, if the febrile neutropenia rate is 10% like it was in the subset analysis, and whether dose intensity will be better and maybe results will be a little bit better than the Echelon trial.
So, you know, the cost issue is always a really difficult one to sort out. But if we put it aside and just look at clinical risk and benefit, do you think it is incumbent on physicians, oncologists, to go through the two alternatives in terms of potential risk? You mentioned the bleomycin, you mentioned the peripheral neuropathy, and potential differences numerically in outcomes for all people with extensive stage disease.
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you something. This is really a question of being maybe a good doctor, but not a good citizen. So in the U.S., we have this kind of disorganized healthcare system. And for my patient, for example, who I decided to use BV plus AVD, the insurance company will pay for it. So what's the difference, you know, to me or to him? I mean, this is an increased cost, and we are able to do it in this country. In countries that have government health care, provincial health care like in Canada, or government like in Western Europe, then, you know, the insurer is the people and it's the government, and they have to decide, make decisions on to what difference they're going to require to justify an increased expense. So in this country, I think it's easier to give BV plus AVD because if the patient is on label and has good insurance, they'll pay for it anyway. So sometimes I think, you know, I give a treatment that was a little bit better on a clinical trial, not only on the Echelon trial, but on other trials. And I sometimes say, okay, you know, I'm being good for the patient because there's a little bit better result and, you know, the insurance will pay for it. But, you know, if you're really looking at costs of healthcare, you know, I mean, that's a different consideration. So I'm sorry if that's a little bit long-winded answer, but it's really...
No, I think it's a really, I mean, it's just such a difficult, challenging issue for every single oncologist. But I was thinking about the fact in a patient like yours, so if there's a 10% difference, and that 10%, they're going to be getting transplant and a lot of expensive therapy. I wonder if a patient like that, it actually is cost effective.
Well, you know something, I was involved with a cost analysis done with Truven, which is part of IBM. They have a very large database of insurance claims. And so they did an analysis of the costs of failure to frontline therapy for Hodgkin lymphoma based on their insurance database, which I guess is commercial insurance and Medicare. And so I'm not really that acquainted with that type of analysis, which is clinically not the greatest, but it is very large numbers. And bottom line, and this is kind of a technical paper, bottom line is they made an estimate of what the cost of failure of frontline therapy would be at 5 years following diagnosis. And they estimated around $500,000. So again, I think the costs of salvage therapy, transplant, and so on for the patients who have to be salvaged versus the initial cost of initial therapy, I think is something that, you know, has to be looked at. And as I say, I'm not an expert on analyzing insurance claim databases, but I thought this was a very interesting study, and it is published in one of the healthcare outcomes journals.
Really interesting. Why don't we finish out and talk about relapse disease? You just referred to it, and I asked you to pull a case from your practice of a patient who got a checkpoint inhibitor, and you have this 40-year-old man. What happened there?
This guy is really an unfortunate patient, and it's a very complicated history. He basically has had 20 years of Hodgkin lymphoma. I didn't treat him initially. He had stage 2B Hodgkin lymphoma, nodular sclerosis. He was treated with ABVD and radiation therapy. In 1998, he relapsed in 2001, got ESHAP, GVD, and an auto transplant, and then relapsed again after the transplant in 2004, got MAB and rituximab and GVD again, relapsed in 2007, got MOP variant using chlorambucil and vinblastine plus ICE, and relapsed, had progression again in 2011. He developed bone involvement and bone pain. He got palliative radiation therapy to his lumbar spine and progressed in 2012. He got brentuximab vedotin, which is approved and originally was approved for post-transplant relapse setting, which was given, not by me, with vinblastine for reasons that I don't know, and it had to be stopped because of peripheral neuropathy. He progressed in 2013 with increased back pain, with alcohol, night sweats, terrible pruritus, dyspnea with exertion, and a bronchial biopsy, transbronchial biopsy, showed recurrent Hodgkin lymphoma. So then we saw him. He was on a clinical trial with an HDAC inhibitor, ronodepsin plus lenalidomide, and progressed on that. Another axillary node biopsy was performed in 2015, and he was entered on the nivolumab clinical trial, which was a pivotal trial, and was treated on nivolumab successfully for about a year, but according to protocol criteria, because of abnormal liver function tests, he had to be discontinued. And he is still living, but he has really been through everything, actually is just on prednisone now. But anyway, that was a patient who was treated on the pivotal trial. Dr. Yunus, who is our service chief, was actually the first author on the publication for that. Results were excellent. There was a 66% overall response rate and I think a 20 or 30% CR rate, which led to approval of nivolumab for relapsed Hodgkin lymphoma following transplant and brentuximab vedotin. So again, that was an example of a very long treatment. He continued on the treatment, and it had to be stopped just because of toxicity as defined in the protocol. Today, I'm not sure that's in the label. Actually, we did actually try to retreat him with pembrolizumab, which was also approved on a basis of a different clinical trial with similar results to nivolumab, the other checkpoint inhibitor. And he didn't respond to that. But anyway, he had a prolonged response. So that would be my example of using these drugs in heavily relapsed patients.
If I could, I'd like to just throw out a bunch of sort of clinical questions to you in terms of how you manage relapse disease. So my first question is, what is your current non-protocol approach to systemic therapy as a bridge to transplant? Are you using chemo? Do you add novel agents, bevacizumab, and checkpoint inhibitors?
Well, Allison Moskowitz, my colleague, conducted a very nice small phase two study, which used brentuximab vedotin in a little bit different schedule than the every 3 week or 2 week schedule, using weekly times three with a week off, either two or three cycles of this in patients in first relapse after primary treatment, and about a third of the patients achieved PET negativity and went directly on to transplant. Those who were still PET positive went on to our standard treatment with ICE. We actually used the augmented form of ICE for two cycles and went on to transplant. So two-thirds were still PET positive and got ICE. And the results were excellent in both groups using two or three cycles of BV before that. It seems if you add another drug, like you add BV to a checkpoint inhibitor, or if you add bendamustine, as Anne LaCaisse did, to BV, you can increase the PET negativity rate to about 60%. So in our practice, I kind of follow the results that Allison Moskowitz published. That is, I'll give patients two cycles of rintuximab vedotin, and if they're PET negative, I go on to transplant. If they're PET positive, I give them ICE and transplant. The combination of nivolumab and rintuximab vedotin is not approved for that particular use. The combination of bendamustine and rintuximab vedotin has a little bit more toxicity, so I'm not particularly switching to that. But I think for now, I'm using BV first, see if I can get them into a CR, a third of them, and ICE if they don't, and then go to transplant.
Where are you today in terms of the use of post-transplant consolidation with BV vedotin? Your former colleague, Dr. Craig Moskowitz, was the head of the ATHERA trial that looked at that. Could you talk about right now, outside a trial setting, how you utilize that strategy, if at all, in your practice?
Yes, that was a randomized controlled trial of BV maintenance in patients after transplant at particular high risk of relapse. And I guess these are patients with extranodal disease, with a short disease-free interval after primary treatment before going to transplant, and I think with extranodal disease. So these patients are a particularly high risk after transplant, higher risk of relapse. So in that group of patients, they were randomized to either maintenance BV every 3 weeks or placebo. And I believe there was a crossover also, but there was a significant difference in PFS for the maintenance arm versus the placebo arm, which was statistically significant, though there was no overall survival benefit, which is true of most trials for Hodgkin lymphoma in general. So I think that BV maintenance is, absent a survival benefit, I think it's a discussion with patients after transplant, but not a mandate. I mean, the risks are, I guess really the major risk is peripheral neuropathy, and usually the drug is stopped when you develop peripheral neuropathy, which usually improves when you stop the drug, but not always completely. So I think, you know, certainly for patients at high risk after transplant for relapse, it's definitely an option, but I don't think it's a mandate unless there's a survival benefit.
And in terms of relapse after transplant, let's say in the patient who's naive to BV vedotin, what's your usual, again, non-protocol strategy?
I think you have an option of either BV vedotin or a checkpoint inhibitor, either nivolumab or pembrolizumab. I think that the label for nivolumab may require prior BV, and I think the label for pembrolizumab does not require BV. So I think those are options. And then there are combinations. There's combination of BV and AVD. There are combinations of BV plus nivolumab, which are under, you know, investigation, clinical investigation. They're not particularly, have not really been published in full form. Actually, I think the BV plus nivolumab has been published by Alex Herrera. So I think probably a standard would be a single agent, either BV or Nivo or Pembro, although I think Pembro has a little bit more liberal label.
Do you believe that there's a subset of patients? I've heard people talk about maybe 30% who are cured or have very prolonged disease-free interval and control of disease, relapse disease with BV alone.
Yes. I mean, there is data. And I think it's in the neighborhood of 20%, something like that, have prolonged remissions. Again, their BV is usually continued until patients start to develop neuropathy, but there is a tail. on the pivotal trial curve that has people in continuing remission.
Any new directions in the management of Hodgkin lymphoma that you want to comment on?
Well, I think these checkpoint drugs are really interesting. I mean, Hodgkin lymphoma is a disease where we've cured 70 to 90% of patients for 40 years. So the question is, you know, one is, can we improve on that, which is a really difficult thing to improve 5 to 10%. And I think also how to have a better outcome at 10 or 20 years, reducing the risks of treatment, initial treatment. And I think radiation therapy is really the hugest issue there. But I think now for the first time, we have drugs that are not chemotherapy and not radiation therapy that work. I mean, rituximab and vedotin is really chemotherapy with a different delivery system, antibody-drug conjugate, but it's still chemotherapy. But, you know, the checkpoint drugs are immune therapy, and I think that's very exciting. And I think the incorporation of these earlier in treatment and maybe even to eventually a goal of whether an immune approach can even replace chemotherapy is something that I think is really going to be of interest to investigate in the future. And it may be that other immune approaches may also be promising. I mean, I think there are CAR T-cell studies for Hodgkin lymphoma. I believe the group at the NCI has one. So I think the immune approaches, incorporating them, is going to be the direction of future investigation.
I was going to ask you about CAR T and Hodgkin lymphoma. What do we know about that, and what is the target?
The target is CD30. They're under investigation. I don't know exactly the results. I think they have not treated a huge number of patients. There are some promising results, but I think the results are pretty early.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting in a way. It was very surprising to see how sensitive HL is to checkpoint inhibitors. But as we learn more about the biology and think about what we knew about the disease, in a way, it wasn't a surprise. But, you know, it's a little bit disappointing now that I think about it, because we've known that now for a few years. And I guess there are trials integrating it into the upfront setting, but it doesn't seem like there's anything. Is there phase three trials that are sort of mature and ready to go?
No, there aren't. I think the intergroup, we have a trial now for advanced disease, similar design to the RAFL trial for stage 3 and 4 disease. Allison Moskowitz, again, is the head of this trial, where we are giving stage 3 and 4 patients two cycles of ABVD, conducting an interim PET. And for the 75-80% of patients who are PET negative, we're continuing as per RAFL with four cycles of AVD eliminating bleomycin. And for the PET positive, we're substituting nivolumab plus AVD for escalated BICOP. So I think this is an attempt in the PET positive group, who we think we have, you know, a higher, maybe a 65% risk of relapse, to try to reduce that. I think there is a North American trial that is going to be started in the intergroup, including pediatrics, of BV plus AVD versus nivolumab plus AVD, a big randomized phase three study. So none of these trials are eliminating chemotherapy, because if you're curing 70 to 90% of patients with chemotherapy, it's very hard to kind of ease away from that. But they're adding and incorporating the immune therapies.
Can you envision sort of a risk-adapted approach using novel therapy? I mean, if they come up with a really effective, let's say, combination of BV and, say, a checkpoint inhibitor, the model of, you know, PET negativity and you're done.
Well, I mean, again, you're curing 70 to 90% with chemotherapy. And if you eliminate radiation therapy, you're really eliminating most of the risks for long-term toxicity. So it's tough. I mean, you really, it's going to have to be stepwise. I mean, I don't know that in a curable disease, that I would be very enthusiastic about substituting just immunotherapy as frontline in newly diagnosed patients. I mean, actually, there is a very interesting phase two study, which we participated in, has been published in preliminary form, I think by Andy Evans, Paul Hamlin is guiding this in our center, which used BV lead-in in older patients who are at risk for toxicity, and then followed that with AVD, and then followed that with BV maintenance. And the results of that are really quite promising in that older group of patients at particular risk for bleomycin toxicity. So that's another trial that used brentuximab vedotin, which is still chemotherapy, but you know, really starting with a lead-in with that in untreated patients. But I think, you know, we have to be a little cautious about, I mean, yes, I'm very enthusiastic and happy that we have stuff that works other than chemotherapy, but chemotherapy does work, and we have to just do it stepwise.